Thank you. Here's Teresa of Avila. Clarity is freedom. I had tea yesterday with a great theologian, and he asked me, "What is your experience of God's will?" I like that question, for the distillation of thought hones thought in others. Clarity, I know, is freedom. What is my experience of God's will? Everyone is a traveler. Most all need lodging, food, and clothes. I let enter my mouth what will enrich me. I wear what will make my eye content. I sleep where I will wake with the strength to deeply love. All my mind can hold. What is God's will for a wing? Every bird knows that. I'm going to sniff at it. It's because I'm so deeply moved about what I'm talking about. And because I was on Iona last week, and I know lots of you have been there, and our airline sent our baggage on pilgrimage to a different man, which meant that the sandals that work for the North Carolina climate were all we had to wear for 3 days on Iona, and hence I have been blessed with a cold. I'm totally thrilled to be here. This is a very strange experience for me to look out on an audience full of my own Sunday school teachers, basically. and dear friends and people that I've known for a long time and a lot of new faces. Thank you all so much for coming to have a conversation with Brian and with myself. We're here to lead a retreat that starts tomorrow, bringing over people from mostly from North America to give them an experience of spirituality and peace building here in this place. And it's also a beautiful opportunity to come and share some conversation tonight. How it's going to go is I'm going to tell you a story now, and then Brian's going to make a presentation, and then I will wrap up, and then we'll have some questions. I think we're calling questions and response, because we don't necessarily have answers. So if you were here for anything else, you're still welcome to stay. So, about 18 years ago, I was living on Tate's Avenue, which is just down there, and I took a month-long trip interrailing around Europe with a group of three other friends. And at the end of the month, there were 2 days left, and decided to split up into four individual groups and go to a part of Europe that each of us wanted to go to that the others didn't want to go to. And I wanted to go to Paris, because I'd never been to France before, in my the City of Lights. And so I took a train. We were in La Rochelle in France for those last couple of days. And then I took a train by myself to Paris. I was going to be there for one night. The person whose apartment I stayed in that night is in this room tonight. I just realized that. That's remarkable. Because this story is actually about how things are going on all the time that we don't notice. There's something bigger happening. So you're in Paris for a night, you go to the Eiffel Tower, and when you're 22, you can't afford to get into the Eiffel Tower. So what you do instead is you lie down underneath the Eiffel Tower and you look up at the inside, the underside of the Eiffel Tower. And I lay there for about 10 minutes on the gravel, and the beautiful thing about this is I have a view of the Eiffel Tower that nobody else has. When someone says Paris, I don't see the Eiffel Tower upright. I see it from underneath. And it's kind of like a womb getting ready to give birth, which is appropriate because something was born in me this night, 1997. Now, I don't want to overstate the point because 10 minutes of looking at the other side of the Eiffel Tower is enough. And I decided to get up and go down to the bridge beside the Eiffel Tower. It's called the Pont de l'Alma. Had some cigarillos with me. Are there any cigar aficionados in the room? Please raise your hand. They've got, come on, there's more than two. wine in the church, it's okay to say yes. So those of you, thank you for those of you who know, is that Cohiba cigars are one of the classic Cuban cigar brands. In fact, for a period of time, Fidel Castro had Cohibas produced for his exclusive personal use. Which is good. He's doing pretty well to be the age that he is. Very distinguished leader. He should have had him play Gandalf. Gosh, can you imagine the Hobbit with Fidel? Can you imagine the Hobbit with anything good in it? So I had these 10 Cohiba cigarillos that I bought on our shelf. That smoked 5 of them. When I bought them, it was the single most expensive item purchase I'd ever made. It cost me about 25 quid. I'd never spent 25 quid on anything before. And I'd smoked these 5 in the previous 3 days. So I had 5 left. And I was sitting by the pomelo smoking one of these cigarillos. When I noticed a man start coming toward me with an intent, it was clear he wanted to talk to me. It was also clear that this was a man who was in trouble. I smelled him before I could talk to him. He had been unwashed for several days. He was drunk. He was clearly high. And he sat down and asked me if he could have one of my cigarillos. I said, yes, and started to talk. His name was Jean-Marc. He was from Switzerland. He'd been in the Swiss Army, you know, the company that makes the knives. He'd come to Paris 5 months previously, fallen on hard times, and now he's living outside, homeless. He was very sad. I remember at one point he said, Paris only cares about tourists. She doesn't care about her own people. Which has stayed in my mind every time I've gone to a new city. When I think about my own city, sometimes it's amazing. Ireland and this part of Ireland has this international reputation for incredible hospitality toward strangers, but not to each other. We have this incredible international reputation for doing the opposite of hospitality to each other. And he was the strength. So it came time for me to get ready to take the last metro home. And I decided I wanted to give him some money. So I asked him if I could give him some money, and he said, no, he didn't want any money. And I got the sense that it was this thing about dignity in it, that to give him the money would have been to make him inferior in some way. So then I thought, well, is there anything else I can give you? And I really, really hoped that he wasn't going to say any remaining 3 cookies. But that's what he said. And so, you know, with gritted teeth that lit, and the audible voice of Jesus and Sinead O'Connor compelling me, it's one thing to pull something out of the clutch of somebody else, it's another thing to pull it out of your own clutches. And I gave him the remaining cigarillos. And then he reached in his little backpack and took out a set of electric hair clippers that he found on the street the day before, and he gave them to me as a treat. And then he embraced me, and then he kissed me on both cheeks the way the French do, and then he pulled my face in really close, and he kissed me full on the lips for 3 or 4 seconds. I can still feel his stubble on my face, and I can still taste the alcohol on his lips. Then he moved about an inch away and held my head in his hands and said, Je n'ai pas le sida, je vous fais plaisir, which means I don't have AIDS, I'll give you pleasure, presumably if you pay me. And in that moment, I realized he has assumed all the way through this conversation that there's an ulterior motive on my part here. He's been so broken by his circumstances that he can't see simple act of kindness as a simple act of kindness, that there has to be some kind of transaction at the end of this. It's because of how wounded he is. And I went away that night and thought about this a lot, and eventually developed the perfect little sermon, which is basically what I've just told you plus one conclusion. And the conclusion was, it wasn't because of his woundedness that he reacted as if this was a transaction. It was because my posture toward him was the way I had been taught to be as a Christian growing up in this society, which is that people who are not like you are targets for evangelism. And that the very best thing you can do with someone who's not like you is to have a good conversation about Jesus. You never, for a moment, think that they might have something to give you, or to teach you, or to serve you with. There are always these little robotic boxes ready to be programmed with your right beliefs. So I realized when we approach people on the basis of we've got something we don't have, it's no wonder if they react like there's some kind of consumer transaction going on. And that became a perfect little sermon, and I told that talk in many places for about 14 years. It was my John Hughes talk about a single transferable speech. And you know, I thank God he made that speech, so we were not a divided land, but a divided people. It was my single transferable speech until 4 years ago, when I was in a church in North Carolina, which is a state I didn't know much about until I moved there, giving a talk about the Wild Goose Festival that I was involved in finding. And I told this story to try to make the same point. And just before I came to the rhetorical flourish that I was so proud of, the pastor of the church got up and walked out of the room. Now, I don't know how many people here are public speakers. I see some people in the room who I've been in the audience when you've been speaking. You know how you feel when someone gets up and walks out? What if it's the host? What if it's the pastor? You really sort of, what have I done? And so I sort of stumbled toward the end of the talk and kind of wrapped up. And frankly, just before I was in the last sentence, he came back in the room with a big smile on his face and something in his hand. I finished, I came up on the stage, and he said, "Thank you, Gary. I'm really glad you're here today, and I think these are yours." And he had me open the box. And I opened the wooden box, and inside the wooden box were three Churchill-sized Cohiba cigars. Now, Churchill-sized are the size that Churchill smoked. Cigarillos are the size of your little finger. These were the same brand and the same numbers. And they arrived in North Carolina in this church the same week that I did, because a friend of this pastor had been to Cuba the week before and had decided to buy him three Cohiba cigars. And when he gave these cigars to me, I actually was speechless. Those of you who know me believe there it is. And what it came to mean to me was, I thought I knew what that story was about. I thought I knew that that story had ended in Paris in 1987. And that it was all about how I learned this life lesson from this program. But actually, when the three cigars showed up again 14 years later across the ocean, I realized you never know when a story's over, especially when you're in it. You never know when a story's over, especially when you're in it. And if you're suffering at the moment, I hope it might be some comfort to you that maybe the point that feels like the end might not feel like that in the future. If you're in pain at the moment, know that maybe the story isn't over. Maybe something's going to happen that you can't predict. And if you don't know that, what I hope you know is that there's a community of people who will be with you in the pain. So for the next 2 years, I told the story to Alec. And I got it done in a fine art, a 10-minute little piece that we finished it. And you never know when a story's over, especially when you're in it. 2 years ago at Greenbelt, many of you have been there, and if you haven't been, please go. It's the last time I did the last weekend of August. It's like this, except for 5 days and a lot of money. I gave the talk again, and then I left the room where I was giving the talk and went over to the beer tent where some some of my friends were sitting. One of those friends is in the room now. I had a beer. I went up to use the loo. I came back to the table, and there was a Churchill-sized green cigar on the table. And I said, "Who's going on that?" Clearly someone heard this story, and now cigars are going to start showing up wherever I go. I wish the story had been that it had been about 1,000 pounds. There was a woman there who I'd never met before. And she's here, I don't want to embarrass her. And she just been to Cuba and brought some Cuban cigars to Green Mountain. And I remember she said, "Make a spot in my mind." So the meaning of the story became advanced one more time. You never know when a story's over, especially when you're in it. Perhaps most especially when you make your living from telling stories. We are a community. Some of us live in other places. We are a community bound by the idea that there was a teacher 2,000 years ago that had something profound to say that transcends everything else. And we are a community, many of us, who have been wounded by our attempts to follow that teacher within the structures that we got born into, or that we got saved into, or that we got landed into, or that we founded, or that we tried to lead. We're telling a story. The story of what Christianity is told most loudly in this society kills people, even if it's just on the inside, the one that's told the most loudly. Our job, I think, is not to engage in opposition to that story or to those storytellers, because those storytellers are just believing their thoughts. And we didn't know something until we knew it. The worst thing you can do when you know it is to try to tell other people that you're superior to them. My hunch, as I have lived away for 7 years and I come back every year, my hunch is that we could find some hope in embodying the idea that you never know when a story's over, especially when you're in it, most especially when you're trying to tell it. You don't have to control the story. The story can change, and things that you once held dear can just float away. The things that you thought you would never believe can become the most obvious manifestation of love. Tiny little postscript. My partner was sitting in the front row. Pointed out to me, after all this, yeah, transactional relating creates consumerist friendships. You're right. And you never know when a story's over, especially when you're in it. And you never know when a story's over, especially if you make your living from telling the story. Those are all true. But Gareth, you've missed the most important core of this story. I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Something happened to you that everybody wants. And it never happens to anybody. But it happened to you. And you don't even know it." This is 2 years ago, so it was 16 years since it happened. I'm wrapping up breakfast. I lay down under the Eiffel Tower. Well, big deal. No. The archetype of romantic love, the thing that every single person who grows up in the West hears is the most romantic thing that could ever happen to you, actually happened to me. And that is, I was kissed by a stranger under the Eiffel Tower. He gave me a gift, and for nearly 2 decades I thought it was me doing the gifting. I wonder if Jean-Marc is actually the protagonist of that story and not me. And I wonder if those of us who feel the call to stay connected to the idea of Christianity, while we know so much about the damage that the institution has done, I wonder if what we are called to is to be the kisser. To be the one that kisses the person who doesn't even know we're giving them a gift. What that kiss might look like is the subject of what Brian is going to talk to us about.